It's pretty hard, I think, to forget that terrible tragedy a couple of years back at Dreamworld where four people were killed when the Thunder River Rapids ride malfunctioned, and there's been an inquest into it, I think, this week. I was reading about it in the newspaper, and I hadn't realised that the lady operating the ride, a young lady by the name of Courtney Williams, it's her first day on the job when that happens. So sad. And lots of questions too about that. But one thing that really grabbed my attention as I was reading about it, when she was being pushed about her training and what she was doing, after giving evidence, she was highly distressed, and she said, "I would have done everything I could have to save the people who were victims." But she wasn't able to save. She's willing, but not able. I'm not being flippant. Things like that actually make me very reticent of ever putting my life in the hands of others to look after me or the people I love. People might be willing to help you, but they're not always able to. Now, I reckon David finds himself in a similar kind of conundrum, a similar terrible place to Courtney Williams at the end of 2 Samuel. He's willing to save, whatever the cost, but actually not really able to do it, not really able to save his people. I mean, this is the last glimpse that you get of David. This is God's Messiah in the works of 1 and 2 Samuel, this story that is primarily about the kingdom of God coming to earth during the reign of David. This part of the book, you're in an epilogue, as it were, the last four chapters. It's the writer's reflection on David and on his rule. Last week, at the centre of that epilogue, you got that song there in chapter 22, the sung eulogy, if you like, of David's life. And it's fairly positive because it shows here is a man whose rock and refuge in life has been God himself. Very positive reflection. But this isn't so positive, is it? Chronologically, I'm not sure where this comes exactly in David's life, but I think it's significant that it's placed here, the end. You see the persistent problem in David's kingdom. It's the problem of, well, Israel's sin and David's own sin, but also the problem of God's wrath, his right anger over sin. And what you see is David is willing to try and save Israel from God's anger, but he really can't. And so it's like this is the take-home message that the editor or the author, the narrator of all of this wants you to chew on. What's it really going to take to deal with God's wrath in David's kingdom, but for all time? Lots of questions about Israel's particular sin here and why God is angry. Not a lot of answers, but I think the first thing I want you to see in all of this is that, well, God's wrath, there's something mysterious about it. Verse 1, people get themselves into all kinds of conniptions about this verse. Look at it there. "Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. He incited David, saying, 'Go and take a census of Israel and Judah.'" You know, why is he angry? What's the sin? The "again" maybe takes you back to the beginning of chapter 21, which kind of parallels this. God's anger is burning against Israel, and it's over things that Saul did. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's just because Israel had rejected David at some point, and they installed Absalom as king. Is it just that they're persistently sinful? Possibly. But the thing is, we just don't know. It's a mystery. And what's wrong with censuses? I mean, I know the last one we did was a bit of a pain and all that sort of stuff, but in the book of Numbers, God tells Moses to take a census of Israel. Maybe it's got to do with David's intent in taking a census. Now, is it about him finding out what kind of firepower he's got at his disposal? In verse 2, you notice it's about enrolling the fighting men. And you check the numbers then in verse 9 that are counted. It's pretty impressive. It's the kind of thing that perhaps could make him a bit, I don't know, smug and complacent. You know, maybe the problem is about him treating Israel, God's possession, as his possession, just a number. Whatever it is, that Joab in verse 3 there, and this is a guy whose moral compass is always a bit skewy, that he thinks it's bad that should alert us to something. In verse 10, you notice David is conscience-stricken. He says to the Lord, "I've sinned greatly." I mean, I think of it this way. It seems like this in comparison to what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. Well, that's chicken feed in comparison to how he feels about this. There's a mysterious reason for God being angry. But the bigger mystery, and perhaps it's what unsettles you, again, how is it in verse 1 that David can be incited by God to do something that's wrong, but it actually serves God's purposes against Israel, and David is still regarded and regards himself as guilty? And the short answer is, I don't know. You're starting to stare then at this point at the mysterious relationship between a sovereign God and sinful humans who make real and sinful choices. And at this point, you know, some people try to invoke the parallel account of this in 1 Chronicles. You can read it later, 1 Chronicles 22. In verse 1, you're told that Satan rises up against Israel and incites David to do this. And they go, aha, it's the old devil made him do it thing. But that fails to take into account that Satan is just another creature, like you and me. And he mysteriously serves God's purposes. And if he's not just another creature who does that, we should be really worried. This is the mysterious way God's anger and wrath over sin works. I think we need to be careful with this, though. We don't think of God's wrath as being some arbitrary thing without any reason, even if we don't know the reason. If God also was ambivalent, uncaring about sin, that would perhaps be more disturbing than him being angry about it. I mean, if he doesn't care, is he good? As I've been chewing over this and thinking about why this bothers me, thankfully I've found in a commentary by a guy called Ralph Davis some really helpful questions to reflect on, some penetrating questions. He says it better than I can, so I'll just rip him off. He asks this: do we perhaps assume that God must always explain himself and justify his ways? If we cannot be content to accept the mystery of this text, maybe we're revealing something about ourselves. If we're upset over a text that tells us that Yahweh is angry but doesn't tell us why, are we not saying that we really don't trust him to be just? Is there not a strain within us that insists that there must be no mysteries in God? Don't we sometimes subtly assume that God owes us an explanation? Are we angry because God is not perfectly transparent? And I find myself thinking, yeah, that's my problem. Are we like that? You know, what do your responses to stuff like that reveal about your heart and about your willingness to worship God for who he is? I'd say it's the mysterious God who you can't pin down on everything, but who cares about sin. They're the God who's actually worthy of worship. Anything less than that isn't God. Well, there's another mystery here. God's wrath is mysterious. The second thing you see is that his wrath is mysteriously matched by his mercy. So moving on through the passage, you start to see the severity of God's wrath. You know, in verse 10, David prays for his guilt to be taken away. And then you look at verse 11 there. He spends the night, I suspect, on his face praying for that. And God's word then comes via Gad, his prophet. And he hears what he doesn't want to hear. There's three choices there, isn't there, in verse 13. There's 3 years of famine. This is what you could have, David. Or 3 months of defeat. 3 days of plague, and you just get the feeling that as the time decreases, the horror of these judgments increases. And without getting too far ahead of ourselves, you know, think about Black Death, right? You know, bubonic plague, 70,000 people perhaps decimated within a day. That's a big dent in David's kingdom that took 9 months to count. It's very distressing. But there's something worth paying attention to in this. And again, you know, we don't know exactly when this comes in David's reign. I think it comes probably later in his life. You see the rightness of David's spiritual instincts about God. I mean, here's a guy who gets lots and lots of stuff wrong, but actually a guy who gets lots right. Look at verse 14. He says to Gad when he's presented with these options, "I'm in deep distress. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but don't let me fall into human hands." Now, he doesn't actually specifically make a choice. He understands, though, that the wrath of God is wrapped in God's mercy. He's about to meet that wrath, but he's convinced that God is merciful. The hand that strikes is somehow going to be the hand that will spare him and his kingdom, mysteriously so. You just do get the feeling, I think, with David, ever since his sin with Bathsheba and the horrid thing that he does to Uriah, it's almost like from then on he is a guy who really is convinced of God's mercy. His best, you know, theologising, if you like, it comes out by reflex when he's in a mess. The crucible's done some refining. And David's one of those people, really, who knows their God, not just that they know about him. How does that square? Or how does that compare, actually, with the way you think about God, especially in those really dark times? Maybe even those times that are a consequence of sinful choices that you've made. Do you think, oh, let me fall into God's hands? And that's not fatalism. That's not let go and let God, whatever that means. He's convinced, absolutely so, of God's mercy. And he's proved right, isn't he? Look at verse 15. You know, the plague is sent. Verse 16, it appears to be this angel of the Lord stretching out their hand. They're the agent of this. And it lets up. Verse 15, you read there, the plague works from that morning until the end of the time designated, probably better translated to the appointed time. And I think it's a tip-off that maybe this plague doesn't run for the full 3 days. Because in verse 16, you see the God's eye perspective of this, if you like. The angel stretches out his hand to destroy Jerusalem. The Lord relented and says, "Enough, withdraw your hand." You know, you imagine this kind of creeping black death, shadow cast over the land, and it comes to the floor of Araunah's threshing floor, and it stalls. And why? God's mercy. His mercy towards Jerusalem, the place, you know, where he's been seen fit to let his name dwell, the place where his Messiah is on the throne. It's precious to him, and in mercy he relents. And it's not, you know, whoops, I made it, you know, made a mistake again. Changes his mind in purely human terms. It's that his mercy is aroused by seeing people face God's judgment, his own judgment. And that's a constant character trait of God. And again, David's instincts about this are right. And do you share that kind of confidence that David has in God's mercy to you and for others? Do you share a sense, I guess, of God's heart for people too? I mean, he's angry about sin, but he's also compassionate towards sinners who are wallowing in the muck of it all. He really doesn't delight in sinners getting what for. And neither should we. Also need to be clear about this here. I think what comes out of this is that God's mercy is not subject to us doing the right thing. It's not contingent on David choosing the right choice. It's not a result of David's incredible prayer there in verse 17, which we'll come back to in a moment. You know, David prays, but I think the way the writer has put things together here, the sequence of events, what they're trying to show you, as clunky as it is that it's God who makes the first move. He chooses to stop. It's his sovereign mercy that tells the angel to withdraw their hand. But what emerges, I think, as we move along here, is that while God's mercy halts his anger, it doesn't actually satisfy it. The plague stops, but the wrath behind that plague is still there. And the tip-off to that is that God actually tells David to go and build an altar. And that's the third and final thing here. You know, for God's wrath to be dealt with, to be satisfied, there's a costly sacrifice that has to be made by the Messiah to satisfy it. It's David's instinct, isn't it, in that prayer in verse 17. Have a look at it there. He says, "I have sinned. I, the shepherd, have done wrong. These are but sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall on me and my family. I mean, wow. The shepherd is willing to lay down his life for the sheep. Now, he's right about something. Yes, he has sinned, and he's right that some sacrifice needs to be made, but he's wrong about Israel, isn't he? Whatever it is they've done, they're not innocent. And he's wrong about the sacrifice too. While he's willing, it's not what's needed right now. God's got something else in mind. So verse 18, Gad instructs him to build an altar at Arauna's threshing floor. You know, that's the place where the grain gets separated out from the husk. In the Old Testament prophets, threshing floors are often a symbol of God's judgment. And David comes to buy it. I think it's funny, Arauna wants to do what I call reverse haggling. Here, have it for free. No, I insist I'll pay, says David, because in verse 24, I think he realises that this has to cost. Atonement isn't free. There are no shortcuts. You need the full price. And so the Messiah makes a costly sacrifice in verse 25, and the last line of the passage says there, the Lord answers his prayer on behalf of the land. The plague is stopped. The thing is, though, this is from David's perspective now. You know, he's saying the plague stops because of the sacrifice. 70,000 people have died. More people deserve to die. But instead, at God's direction, an animal, at this point, dies in the place of Israel. And it's brutal. It's bloody. But it restrains. It turns aside, God's wrath. His mercy restrains it, but his mercy provides a sacrifice that satisfies it. The thing is, though, you know, when I've been looking at this during the week, we're only talking about stopping a plague. I mean, that's pretty bad, but what about perhaps eternal punishment for sin? And God's anger, you know, as you read on through 1 and 2 Kings, his anger is provoked again by Israel and by David's sons. The problem just won't go away. And David laying down his life for his sheep won't fix this, because the problem is he is as sinful as his sheep. His prayer in verse 17 that God's hand would fall on him and his family to atone for sin, I mean, it's a prayer that actually, in a sense, haunts the pages of Scripture for a long time. But his prayer plus this substitute that's offered at this place give you a glimpse of what will really do it. Now, the place of Arauna's threshing floor, it's actually really quite significant. In 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1, you can go look at it later, it tells you that Arauna's threshing floor is on Mount Moriah. And you read about that back in Genesis 22, possibly 1,000 years earlier. Abraham's instructed to take his son Isaac up Mount Moriah and sacrifice him. You remember the story? And thankfully, God provides a substitute. A ram dies instead of Isaac as God's hand is raised against him. And there's more to this too. In 1 and 2 Chronicles again, Arauna's threshing floor is the place where Solomon, David's son, will build the temple. The place where thousands, countless sacrifices are made for Israel. But I think it gets better. I mean, David's prayer that God's hand would fall on him, well, it's answered 1,000 years later as David's son, Jesus, comes saying in John chapter 10, not just I am the shepherd, but I am the good shepherd, the sinless one, not like David, the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. And you know where he does it? Here. Probably not far from Arauna's threshing floor, I'm convinced, a hill outside of Jerusalem, which well could be Mount Moriah, the site of the old temple. You know, God's hand of wrath that was raised against Isaac, raised against Jerusalem, raised against David, and raised against you and me, it falls on Jesus at the cross. Perfect and complete atonement. It's what the end of 2 Samuel is longing for, a king who is willing and able to save, and that's what we have. Just to close, I think, you know, a passage like this, it shows us the utter sinfulness of sin, doesn't it? I think we can be a bit too easy on ourselves sometimes and we underplay the seriousness of sin and just how bad it is. But think of it this way, if it's no big deal, God's wrath really is him just overreacting, isn't he? And the death of Jesus would be totally unnecessary. But that God prefers to offer a sacrifice for us in our place, you know, he doesn't spare his son. Alarm bells should be ringing for us. I think it's helpful, without being morose and morbid about it, to, I think, reacquaint ourselves with just how heinous sin really is. And that God chooses mercifully to do something with it, it means we should put ourselves in his hands. It's the right thing to do. I haven't read it. I was reading during the week about a novel called Revelation. It depicts a young man admitted to a hospital for the insane. I think it's a fictional novel. This man knows he's a sinner. He knows that God is holy, and it just drives him mad with fear. But when you think about it, that reaction is actually sane. It's sane, in a sense, to be overcome with fear at the prospect of divine judgment. It's insane to know that God is angry about sin and to know that our greatest problem is sin and to not care about it or to downplay it or to deal with it your own way, you know, self-atoning, trying to make good. That's crazy. And self-harming. I mean, I know of people who harm themselves thinking, if I just punish myself a little bit more, God will be pleased. That's terrible. Sane people don't do that. They let themselves fall into the hands of God, his willing and able hands. I've got to say, I really feel for Courtney Williams. I imagine her feeling, an enormous weight of guilt. In the court of public opinion, she and others are probably going to be found guilty, and there's nothing that they can do to atone for that. But what this passage is telling us, that in the court that really matters, you know, she and other people who've done, well, much worse than an error of judgment or a lack of care or negligence, actually people who've sinned in horrible ways, and people who've kidded themselves, like we often do, about the seriousness of sin, there's mercy for us when you say, let's fall into the hands of God, for his mercy is great. How about I pray?